Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cut Podcast. I'm Chad Young here along with Pete Ball, and we are here with episode 66. I have no idea what athletes were best 66. I guess you got to go hockey, right?
Hockey or maybe football. Is football like a, I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of like 60s in football, right?
66 would be like an offensive lineman, but 66, I mean, it's Mario Lemieux, right? I mean, that's the guy who's a 66.
Yeah, the only thing I know about Mario Lemieux is growing up and flipping over the Boston Herald and looking at the scoring leaders and just being like, wow, that guy must be really good because he leads in like every category.
Yeah, I am pulling up a like best 66 in NFL history, and it's like centers and guards and yeah, that's
not a very exciting number. We might be stuck in this rut for a while.
Yeah, we really should have done this earlier in our run because early on there were some good ones.
Oh, here's one. Greatest...
Yeah.
Andrew Bogut from Australia. Yeah, number one overall pick. He was important on those Warriors teams. There we go.
Yeah, okay. That's fair, I suppose.
But you know what? He only wore 66 once, and that was during the 2017-2018 season with the Lakers, so that really doesn't even count. Yeah, yeah. He only played 24 games. Darn.
I'm looking at this, like, I was trying to look up best in MLB history, and I feel like it's just wrong. Like, it mentions Paul Konerko, but Paul Konerko did not wear 66, did he? He wore 14.
I have no idea. Yeah, it doesn't sound right. I think actually I have a Konerko jersey that I don't know. I probably got it when I was like 12 years old.
Why I do not remember Konerko the number jersey?
On it. Probably clearance rack at Burlington Coat Factory.
Well, here I did realize there was a 66, and he's actually a fairly fun 66 in baseball. That's Yasiel Puig.
Yeah, that works. That works. So or Brian Bayo. There we go.
Is he wearing 66?
Apparently. Okay. Yeah, I'm really, really bad with jersey numbers. Like, I can name, like, you know, like, I know Kobe was 8 for a period of time. And I know Tom Brady was 12. But for some reason, that's just something that never stuck with me. I can give all sorts of stats, but when it comes to jersey numbers, I can't do it.
Yeah. So, Bayo, is it Brian?
My understanding is I believe it's Brian Bayo.
Bayo, I have seen confirmed, but I haven't seen anyone confirm the first name, and so I just assumed it was Brian. But it's not spelled like Brian would normally be spelled. So
Now that you say that, I think it is Brian. I'm trying to think of how they called him in the broadcast because they would have it right. Usually the Red Sox broadcast is pretty good with that, and I want to say they said Brian.
Well, we should figure it out because I feel like. And maybe our listeners can tell us if I'm wrong, but I feel like we're going to have a lot of questions about him and a lot of conversation about him later in the season because his debut was not great. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. You can call it awful. It's still a debut. I mean, yeah.
It happened.
It's still tough, you know, but he looked awfully good in the minors this year.
Yeah.
But last year, you know, his performance in Double A was sort of meh last year. He was good in High A, but it was High A. So I think he's going to be sort of an interesting guy as the season goes on and as we get into the off season, because I think he's going to have sort of a mixed track record. And I think he's going to be a guy that people are like, man, his major league performance has been, I think it'll be better than it was at his first start, but I don't expect him to sort of set the world on fire either. So I think you're going to have this guy who, like, the end of the season, you got this, yeah, his major league performance is sort of mediocre. He looked great in the minors, but he doesn't really have a great track record. So, like, what is he and what should I do with him? I think we're going to be discussing that a lot. So,
I don't trust their ability to develop pitching. So,
no,
no, no. Who have they developed?
I guess it depends how you feel about them, but like,
John
Whitlock
Lester.
And Hauk,
I mean,
Whitlock and Hauk are the two most recent ones, right?
They got a lot to prove, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, they do. Is Whitlock really going to stick in the bullpen? Is that really what's going to happen with him?
For this year, yeah. Yeah, the plan is...
Just because of the injury stuff? I mean, like it certainly feels like the Red Sox right now, like their rotation is what, let's see, it's Nick Pivetta, Josh Winkowski, Bayo, and Cutter Crawford.
So
is that it? Do they have a fifth starter?
I assume you're looking at roster resource right now.
I'm actually looking at the MLB at their active roster and trying to figure out, because the other starters on the active roster are Sale, and he'll be back Tuesday. But there it is. Now you've got five. Uvaldi, who's hurt. Waka, who's hurt. Hill, who's hurt. Paxton, who's hurt.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems are they really in a position to not be using Whitlock as a starter?
For the first time since 1945, they started rookies four games in a row. And three of those were against the Yankees. So it's been tough. It's been the injuries. I mean, when healthy, like on paper, it's such a stupid thing to say. And I'm almost annoyed just saying it, because it's like, when is this ever the case? But Chris Sale, Nate Eovaldi, who just had a rehab start. Eovaldi's on his way back. He went like three innings or something like that. Pivetta, Paxton, and then have your pick between Waka and Hill. That's fine. And I think that's what they're hoping for at some point. Like Paxton looks more like August. Who knows what's going on with Rich Hill, but I think they can piece it together, and it's less the injuries. Cause if anything, the injuries would force Whitlock to start. It's just the bullpen sucks. Their bullpen's horrible.
Yeah, that's fair. So I meant more the injuries to Whitlock. Is this just like, are they thinking that they can keep him healthier, but I don't know. It seems like they could use starters, but I get it. I get that they need everything, right? They need pitchers to start. They need pitchers to finish.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is Hauk the closer?
Honestly, like at this point in time, if they needed a save, I think they're going to whoever they feel is the right man for the situation. And in a lot of cases, that's Hauk, because Schreiber's the guy they're leaning on for the big innings where they have that slim
high leverage.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Like historically, the Sox have been really good when they just have the eighth and the ninth locked down. When they get the eighth and the ninth, they can figure out everything else. And I think this bullpen is kind of tailored that way, because there's going to be guys like Crawford, Whitlock, and Hauk who can go multiple innings. So if they get Whitlock back and he and Schreiber can share the eighth and the ninth, we'll figure out the rest. And Crawford's looked pretty good. I claimed him in a couple of our new leagues. He kind of looked nasty his last time out. So they could potentially have something in the bullpen. It's just so bad so far, and that's why Whitlock has to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It's I have Whitlock on a couple teams, and one of the teams I have him on is my OPL team, and he's just not valuable to me. I can't keep him. So I'm going to end up probably either trading or cutting him in the next couple weeks, and that's just super frustrating. Meanwhile, I was about to tell you that, you know, Nick Pivetta is pitching well, but then,
oh Jesus,
he just gave up a home run to Giancarlo Stanton, which
of course he did.
Yeah. He got a strikeout, and then he had two outs, but no, two run shot to Stanton. So
yeah, he was on fire for a while, and I think we all knew that wasn't going to last, but he's their ace right now, and he needs to be their number four starter. So that kind of explains.
Well, I am dealing with my CBS team that I've talked about before. I'm dealing with a roster crunch. And part of my roster crunch is that Whitlock's going to come back. He's on my IL right now. I have one more pitcher that I usually like to carry. And the options of guys to cut are Whitlock, because he's going to be in the bullpen. I think maybe Pivetta. Hauk, if he's not going to close. But I guess he's getting close enough. And then like Kirby just got sent down. And so I have to decide if in a head-to-head league where having a dead roster spot really hurts me, do I just suck it up and keep a dead roster spot for, I'm guessing it'll be about 2 weeks for Kirby. I'm guessing he goes down and comes back shortly after the All-Star break. And I think I'm just going to suck it up, because I think Kirby's that good. But
yeah, there's no way I'm cutting Kirby at those names.
Yeah.
I think it's Whitlock, because he's got to be the assistant to Schreiber, and I think you're right. I think Hauk will probably end up, because he's done it to this point and he's done it fine. He's not been great as a closer. He's been fine. Right. But because he's been somewhat competent and they haven't had something somewhat competent all year, I think that's why he's maybe the guy they turn to, but I don't think there's any answers at this point.
Yeah. Well, if Hauk could get a save tonight, it would really help, because I'm probably gonna have to make that decision tonight, because we do fab on Sunday nights and Wednesday nights in this league. And so I've got decisions to make, and I got to figure out what I want to do.
I would so not you hold your breath
today. That'd be great. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm trying to help you out here as best I can.
Yeah.
So having done 10 minutes on me asking Pete for advice on random Red Sox.
And me giving no answers.
No answers. None whatsoever. But that's okay. You did confirm that Whitlock will be in the pen. So I guess that's something.
Yeah.
That's not really what we wanted to talk about today. Our topic for today came up because of a tweet that Pete sent out. I don't know. When did you send it out? Let's see. A few days ago.
Yeah.
So on July 6th, so we're recording on Sunday the 10th, which you may have figured out by my comment about Stanton taking Pivetta deep in the first, but we're recording on the 10th. On the 6th, just 4 days ago, Pete tweeted out, "Fun with small sample sizes, I will never quit Nick Senzel. Since June 15th, going into tonight," which again, 4 nights ago, "Senzel had 44 plate appearances, 8 runs, 1 home run, 6 RBIs, 3 stolen bases without being caught. A 4.25 average and a 176 WRC plus, only an 18.2% K rate. That day, he was already 2 for 2 with a home run, 2 RBIs, a walk, a run scored." And it got us into this debate about, or conversation about, or discussion about guys we can't quit. And so each of us went through and thought of some guys who have been not great this year, to put it nicely, and that we just can't give up on. And so we're going to talk about those guys. We're going to start, since he was the inspiration for the entire episode, let's start with Senzel.
Yeah, Nick
Senzel.
Talk
to me a little bit about why you can't quit Senzel, or maybe why you should.
No, I'm going to kind of hype him up. I guess why you should, he's kind of like format dependent, or I guess like situation dependent, because I don't expect the power to come anytime soon if it ever arrives in his career. So if you need power, he's not a guy I would necessarily turn to. But I'll talk about that in just a second. Like, he was obviously struggling this year. I think he spent some time in the IL again, which, as we know about Nick Senzel, is not surprising. If he didn't, then it was like inconsistent playing time, or maybe he was just performing that badly. I don't know. But for whatever reason, he was way off my radar. From June 15th to June 22nd, the Reds had two series against two of the best like pitching staffs in baseball. It was against the Brewers and the Dodgers. And over the course of those games, that was about, again, June 15th to June 22nd, Senzel was 2 for 18. Both hits were singles. He struck out 6 times. So if you want to do the math, it's a 30% K rate. And he only had 1 walk. So he was clearly he's a player who is permanently in a rut, who at that point in time was in an even worse rut. But since then, so he ended up getting the day off on the 22nd to clear his head or whatever. And since June 23rd, Chad just read you the stats from that tweet, but if we condense that timeline a little bit more just to fit the narrative better, since June 23rd, he's 23 for 54.
Gotta find the dates that fit the narrative.
Exactly. That's important here. But, you know, I mean, since June 23rd, that's like, you know, 2.5 weeks now or whatever it is. 23 for 54, that's a 4.26 batting average. It's mostly backed up by the expected batting average. He only has 2 home runs, but he does have 3 stolen bases, just a 15% K rate, 8% walk rate, and the launch angle is up at 15 degrees, which is prominent to see. Get those fly balls, get those line drives. He was off today. Now, the thing about Nick Senzel is, like, he's a hit to all fields kind of guy. You know, what I like about his teammate in Brandon Drury, right, is that he pulls the ball and he lifts it in the air. Senzel doesn't really do that, and his exit velocity is really not great. It's nothing to write home about. So that's why I said earlier, I don't expect the power to come, but I can't quit him, because to me, he's kind of like, he has the potential to be Jeff McNeil with speed. You know, like, I think he could absolutely hit 320, 330 with how much he puts it in play, his athleticism, the fact that he very rarely strikes out, and he's very fast. And that is intriguing to me, and he doesn't come without pedigree. So unfortunately, you know, he ever since Jonathan India has come back, he's batting mostly seventh or eighth. But if they do trade Brandon Drury, who now just comes up all the time in our show, I think it's actually kind of funny. But if they do trade Brandon Drury, I think that will bump Senzel back up to the top third of the order, factor in his speed, his bat to ball skills, and just his upside. I'm not ready to quit him. And I can't. I got him for like $2 in the keep or cut Ott New League, and I'm so glad I didn't cut him, because finally maybe things are coming to fruition for Nick Senzel.
I mean, Senzel over his last 10 games for the Reds has had 9 starts, And in those nine starts, looking at from a Fangraphs points perspective for our auto new players out there, he has 64.9 points over nine starts since July 1st. That is excellent, excellent production. I mean, truly elite production. Pete gave you the numbers before, dating back to June 23rd, you said, right? So about 2.5 weeks-ish. Senzel is about 75% rostered in auto new leagues. I'm looking at my CBS league. He's only 23% rostered there. Like there is some, he is available and there is some upside. He just doesn't hit the ball hard enough, consistently enough for me to really believe that he's going to be effective. And maybe that's not fair, but that's my biggest concern, I guess I would say, is like the hard hit rate and the barrel rate just aren't impressive. And like, you even look at like his ex-WOBA, he is underperforming his ex-WOBA. He's got a 293 WOBA on the year, but his ex-WOBA is 313. It's just not enough. I don't know. But I do think the question is like, has something changed over the last month? Since June 1st-ish, something like that. And I just don't know. I don't know what's different. Right. So he's striking out less and walking more, which is good. I'm curious from the plate discipline, like, does the plate discipline back that up? Is there something in his plate discipline? Like in that time, his chase rate is up, his swing rate's up, his contact rate is basically steady. So there isn't a lot in his plate discipline to suggest why he's striking out less. Maybe there's not a lot to suggest why he was striking out more before. Like the other way of looking at this is that his strikeout rate is sort of stabilizing, but it doesn't feel like anything's changed.
It's not that appealing of a fantasy profile because of the lack of power, but it at this point, like we have to see it soon because he's 27 years old, but I'm not ready to rule
27?
Out. I know, it's hard to believe, but...
Oh my God, he just turned 27, to be fair. June 29th. Happy birthday, Nick.
The big thing to me with him, though, is like, it's been injuries and inconsistent playing time his entire career, and he was so hyped up that if finally he just has a consistent role and he's actually healthy, the knee's been drained or whatever it was in the offseason, and he can just focus on playing baseball for the first time in a long time, I think that has some value, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's older and stronger now. We start to see that power come. He plays in the right ballpark for it, that's for sure.
That's true. That's definitely true. I think the thing for me is I would like to see, like, if the argument is that getting the consistent time, having a role, knowing what he's doing was going to help him perform better, I would want to see some evidence of that. He's chasing less because he's getting more comfortable with the zone. He's making more contact because he's swinging, you know, he's getting more swings to the bat. He's hitting the ball harder because he's teeing it up better. Like, none of that is there. The last 3 weeks, none of that is, you know, since that June 23rd date, none of that's there. And so it just leads me to wonder, like, what's changed? The biggest thing that's changed is he has a 488 BABIP over that time. So I'm coming at this from a very different perspective than you because, well, you can't quit him. I haven't been in for like 3 years. But I was sort of
been
curious
a long road.
But I was sort of curious if you were going to like convince me like, hey, he's turning things around and like now is the time. He's a post-hype guy. I don't see it. I'm not ready to buy back in. Maybe that's a mistake, but
I
just don't see it.
I hear what you're saying with the plate discipline stuff and like looking for a change, but I'd argue it's already good that like he didn't need to improve those numbers. He just needs a shot and some clarity and maybe needs to get hot a little bit. And he's now having that opportunity. Like I don't know if there's a way to quantify it. To have a player who had so much hype and dealt with so many injuries and such a crap situation and switching positions, like when they switched his position, he immediately got hurt and was just a disaster to like just finally have a role and just play baseball. And like, I don't know if there's a way to quantify it. And for a player like that, I wouldn't turn to the plate discipline because it was already pretty strong.
Yeah, I still would like to see something to point to. And the only thing I see is BAPIP, and that to me is then like,
yeah, that's a red flag.
Point to, so.
He could be a high BABIP guy, but he's not going to be a 450 or whatever. Yeah, that's yeah. not going to happen.
Agreed. So that's our talk on Senzel. We'll turn to me now, and I'll throw out one of my guys. And this is a guy I wrote about him in the offseason. I've talked about him on here, but Trent Grisham is a guy I just can't quit.
I had a feeling you were going to choose him.
Yeah, I have to talk about Grisham. So Grisham... The thing with Grisham is I love guys who walk a lot and control the strike zone. And while he's never been like a super low strikeout guy, he does walk a lot. He's walked a lot historically. His minor league numbers, like you go back to his time in Double A and Triple A, he was walking, you know, 14-15% of the time. And the thing that was interesting with him is as he progressed through the minors, he was bringing down his strikeout rate. So 2017 at high A, he struck out 24.8% of the time. 2018 at double A, it was down to 21.5%. 2019, he repeats double A and is down to 17.7%. He moves up to triple A in 2019 and it's down to 13.9%. Like there's this clear progression and development that I just love seeing. And then it's like, so that's it. That's the profile I want, right? Walks a lot, progressing in his understanding of the strike zone, striking out less and less over time. And then he comes up and, you know, brief cup of coffee, 51 games, 183 plate appearances in 2019. They're not good. And he breaks out big time in 2020. And he starts off 2021 just as good. And then it all falls apart. And if you take his career, and even including that rough 2019, if you break down his career to before and after May 12th of last year, and that may seem like an arbitrary date, but it's the date on which he got injured running out a ground ball. And so that, I think, was, to me, in the offseason, it looked like a clear break in his season. But now it looks almost like a break in his career, because prior to that, he had 564 career plate appearances, a 116 WRC+. He had a 351 on base, 448 slugging. He had 21 home runs and 17 stolen bases in just under 600 plate appearances, right? So a little less than a full season. He was basically a 2020 guy. Since then, 730 plate appearances. So now you're talking about not just a full season of plate appearances, but like a full season of never missing an at bat for a leadoff guy, and maybe even a little more than that. He has an 88 WRC plus, 18 home runs and 10 stolen bases. So less power, less speed. Now, what's hasn't changed is before he had an 11.9% walk rate and a 25.7% strikeout rate. After, it's down to a 10.4% walk rate, but also down in strikeout rate to 23.2%. So yes, he's walking less, but he's striking out less too. And it's a fairly consistent, there's no major change there. He is, what has seemingly hurt him is his BABIP was 317 before. It is down to 259 after. His home run per fly ball rate was, hold on one second. His home run per fly ball rate was 16.2%. It's down to 10.6%. And a lot of this, unfortunately, is driven because he's actually just not hitting the ball with as much authority. He had a 39.7% hard hit rate and an 8.4% barrel rate prior to that injury last year. Since then, he's at 31.1% hard hit, 5.5% barrel. His average exit velocity is down. His max exit velocity is down. Like, he just isn't hitting the ball with the same authority, even though his plate discipline looks very similar. So that's sort of what's gone wrong. I think for me, the reason I can't quit him is because that plate discipline still looks the same. And I just find it hard to believe he suddenly can't hit the ball as hard as he used to be able to. So I don't know. Then I start to break down and look like, have things improved for him? And they sort of have. So over the last, let's see, what was I looking at here? Since June 7th, so a month roughly, he has a 96 WRC plus, which is not great, but it's a lot better than it had been. And increased his barrel rate. So this is the big thing. He's increased his barrel rate to 8.9%, which is back to above the 8.4% it was in the sort of the first half of his career. That's his hard hit rate is actually not up, but the barrel rate is. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just like reading too much into one number, and it's maybe not the most important number, but like, he's starting to show signs of heading the right direction. I mean, I think if we look at even like a slightly more recent time frame, he's got a, where was it? It was like since like the 17th, it was like, yeah, he's got a 103 WRC plus since June 17th. So like, he's trending up. It's not a huge increase, but he is trending up over the last few weeks. He's got the barrel rate to show it. The walk rate and strikeout rate are still sort of solid in where they are. And the BABIP is still low, which says that there is potentially more correction still coming. So that's where I am on Grisham. He has, I have seen him get cut in some of my leagues. I actually cut him in some of my leagues earlier this year where he was just too expensive to stay with. But he's a free agent in two of my leagues right now at $3 and $5 in auto new. He is a free agent in my CBS league. And I may be trying to pick him up in all of those. Maybe that's a mistake, but I can't quit him. Just can't quit him.
I mean, at those prices, you know, whatever. I mean, $5 may be a little pricey, but if you have it in the middle of the season, why not? And just see where it goes. I guess I'm looking at him maybe just a little bit too simply. And I look at his last 162 games and it's like, give me something. He's supposed to be a speed guy, 9 steals in his last 162 games, just 13 home runs. And the Statcast data is concerning. I get that currently he's trending up, at least in terms of barrel rate, but he's hitting the ball less than 87 miles an hour on average over his last 162. So, you know, you brought up the leg injury. I can't remember if it was calf or heel or what it was. And maybe that plays a factor here. Yeah, and for a guy who relies on speed, maybe that explains the BABIP too a little bit.
It was a year ago.
Right. So, I mean, like, that was
my argument in the offseason, right? In the offseason, when I wrote him up, my argument was everything looked good until this heel injury in May. And then he, like, tried to play through the injury, and then they had to put him on the IL, and then he came back pretty quickly. And it seemed like one of those things they thought would heal, and maybe it never really did. And so there's just like, maybe he just never got right again after that.
Sure.
And maybe it bothered him. Then he had a whole offseason. So I expected this year to be different, and it hasn't been. And here I am telling you all the reasons that, like, it's not enough. But
I guess that's kind of why I bring it up, because, like, looking at his last 162, that might be affected by that, right? So, like, I'm trying to keep that in mind. And when I'm looking at these, it's just he's lucky that that team is so injured, because if C.J. Abrams wasn't like every other major prospect not named Julio Rodriguez and not playing terribly, and Profar was healthy and Myers was healthy, like, this dude has been so bad that it could come into question his playing time. Fortunately, that's not a concern right now. But if they do get healthy, I if he's still doing what he's doing, not necessarily the last 2 weeks, but what he's done over the last year, calendar year, then I would start to get concerned. I cut him in our keeper cut league too. And I forget who I replaced him with. It might have been Austin Hayes, who actually I might cut as well. I don't know if you've looked at him at all, but Camden has destroyed Austin Hayes this year. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Grisham, I was with you. I was in on him going into this year. I thought we were getting pretty good value in drafts. But even if everything begins to go back, like, let's say the BABIP begins to normalize a little bit and things start to trend up, like, what are we really talking about with him? Because we're still looking at a 25% K rate. The walk rate is good, but it's not, like, amazing. And as great as he was in the shortened 2020, is he 20 homers? Is he 20 steals? Or is he under in both?
I think this thing that's when you go back and look at what he was in 2019, 2020, in the first 2 weeks of first month of 2021, right? And that includes a rough 2019. Like, that's not cherry picking, I guess is my point, right? That's who he was before this heel injury. He was 21 home runs and 17 stolen bases, only caught twice in 564 plate appearances. If he can go back to being that with that three, like, if he goes back to that with that 351 OBP, he's going to be back to leading off in that lineup, and he's going to score a ton of runs, and he's going to be a 20-20 guy, maybe even 25-25 over.
He's a top 100 player at that point.
Yeah. But so that's the thing for me, is like, that's the upside, is that he goes back to being, because again, I'm not looking for a new level of production. I'm not looking for him to break out. I'm not looking for him to do something he's ever done before. I'm just saying, go back to being who he was for the first basically two calendar years of his career. And he just hasn't been able to do it, but I really want him to. So let's take a quick break there. And when we come back, we'll move on to a guy who I know you can't quit, but I've got this guy in rosters and I probably should bail, but I'm not going to. Be right back.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball, even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
All right, welcome back. Going through players we just can't quit. And Pete, you can make the case here, but I can't imagine you're going to say anything I disagree with, because I'm right here with you on this guy. Let's talk Jesse Winker.
Yeah, okay. So I want to start by, because this was a tough choice for me between Winker and Jesus Sanchez. But when I dug into the numbers, I looked like, oh man, you know what? Sanchez is really performing like a platoon player. Like, the dude can't hit lefties to save his life. And then I saw the weirdest thing when I looked at the same thing for Jesse Winker, where Winker is inexplicably hitting .247 versus lefties this year. He's career .208. He's a career .208 against lefties. And this year, of all years, Jesse Winker is actually hitting them to the tune of .247. That's because against righties, who he hits for his career at .298, is down to .218. So like, that one thing in and of itself makes me think like there's some positivity coming towards Jesse Winker. Like, things are going to start trending in the right direction, because there's no way he's going to hit .218 against right-handed pitching for the rest of the year. Now, the power is definitely down. He's barreling the ball way less. It's 7.2% barrel rate this year. It was 11.2 in 21, 13.5 in 2020. And his average exit velocity is like way down at 87.3. That's really bad. Wherever it was, however, it was pretty great the last 2 years. So last year he was at 90.6, the year before that 92.1 average exit velocity. So like, maybe that explains the power, and you know, maybe the fact that his ground ball rate is much lower than his career average. And ground balls, as we know, are pretty good for average. And his fly ball rate is way up at 29.4 compared to 23.7 in the past. So maybe that explains the average. Right. So the power's down because the average exit velocity is not there. The barrel rate's not there. And the batting average is down because he's hitting more fly balls, but they're not going anywhere, and they're not going anywhere with speed. So they're all outs. Maybe that's it. But I don't know. If he played all his games back at Great American Ballpark, which I guess is kind of pointless to say and goes against the point, he would have 16 homers. Instead, now that he's in Seattle, he has 6. His career BABIP is .304. It's down at .265 this year, so that might begin to go in the right direction. And his home run to fly ball rate, Chad, his career is 17.5. That's a high number, and I'm sure that's impacted by Great American Ballpark, but this year it's at 6.8. 6.8? Like, maybe it really is just explained by ballpark, and like, he's regressing. We've seen it before. Guys go to Seattle and they begin to regress offensively. But I think there's a middle ground between his 2020, 2021 version that was elite, like really good when it was healthy, and this 2022 version. And I think that middle ground is closer to who he's been in the past than who he's been so far this season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that stands out to me with him is he just had off to a really bad start. Because if you look since June 1st, just as a semi-arbitrary date. But since June 1st, he has a 12% barrel rate. He's at 7.2% of the year. The 7.2%, by the way, includes since June 1st. So if you think about how bad he had to have been in April and May.
That's just crazy.
For that, right. So 12% since June 1st. His home run per fly ball rate, because you mentioned that, and that's been awful. Since June 1st, though, 13.3%. Not at his career route level.
It's about league average.
A lot better. Right. A lot better than his 6.8% for the year. He is... And as a, well, what was the other thing I was going to look at? There was one other number I wanted to throw out there.
BABIP, maybe?
Oh, his BABIP. 265 of the year, 310 since June 1st. And so not a surprise. You know what his WRC plus is since June 1st?
I'm going to guess it's really high.
142.
Yeah.
142.
He's a
right. He's got
high
a 388 on base percentage. And that's a, that is a low power output for him, too, because he still only has a 419 slugging over that time frame. Only four home runs in a little over a month. And so... I sort of think he's already fixed his issues except for the power, and the barrel rate being up gives me hope that that power will return. A little bit like Grisham, the barrel rate's up, but the hard hit rate is not. And so, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I think when barrel rate goes up without hard hit rate going up, it doesn't bode well for the barrel rate staying up, but it's still up. Right now, I don't have any reason to like argue against that. And like that 12% barrel rate, I mean, his barrel rates in 2020 and 2021 were 13.5% and 11.2%. It's like if he's right back to hitting the ball the way you'd expect. I'd also note his ex-WOBA on the year is 360. That is still a big step down, especially in power, from what he's been over the last couple years. But it's good. It's really good. So I think Winker is fine, is what it comes down to. I think he's fine. I think he got off to a slow start. I think that, you know, this suspension, unfortunately, like he had been playing really well, and then he went 0 for 11 in a three-game period. No, not 0 for 11. Sorry, he was. He was 0 for 11. Had 11 plate appearances, struck out four times, did not reach base. And then he got suspended, and he's out for, you know, six games. He's almost done. Today's his last day of his suspension. They don't play tomorrow, but he'll be back on Tuesday. And I'm going to be plugging him back into lineups. I'm still going to sit him against lefties, even though he's been better against lefties this year. I still think you treat him like a platoon bat where you can. But yeah, he's going to be back in my lineup because I think he's fine.
Yeah, I think this is probably the most actionable thing for our listeners so far. Like Senzel and Grisham, it's kind of like Chad and I's like pie in the sky. We're hoping that they begin to turn things around. But Winker is like you said, I mean, since what was it, June 1st, he's basically been himself again. And this suspension, actually, like a week's worth of games, he was dropped in quite a few leagues. He might even have been dropped in my TGFBI league. And so I put in a bid for him. Because of where he was going in drafts, I didn't have him in a lot of leagues just because I liked Jesse Winker, but I liked a lot of the outfielders that were going around him more. But now I have him in a lot because he was dropped. So if he was a guy that was dropped in, you know, your 12-team leagues, even your 10-team leagues, we've seen Winker perform extremely well and outfield is thin. Like he's a guy I'm throwing on my roster if he's available. And if it's a fab league, I'm putting in a pretty substantial bid if Winker is there, because I'm with you, Chad. I think he's not going to be who he was as a Red because you can't replicate that ballpark, especially in Seattle. But I still think he's a very good hitter, and he's going to be that way in the second half.
Yeah, he's also, he is rostered right now in Auto New. He is rostered in 99% of leagues, so he is not available in your Auto New leagues.
Yeah, that's not actually.
He's 85% of CBS leagues, so in CBS.
But as a buy low, like if somebody's frustrated with him, like he's a total buy low.
Yeah, and his salary is like his average salary right now says it's $13.54, median of $13. But like I'm looking at my leagues, and in my leagues, he's 20, 17, 22, 19, 26, 26. Like those are prices at which managers are starting to think like, man, I don't think I'm going to keep him. Like you may be able to buy him from a team that's selling or from a team that's just, like you said, just frustrated, a manager that's just done and wants to move on. I started to think about whether or not I would buy him and realize that in my six leagues, I roster him in three of them. So I don't have that many opportunities to buy.
Oh, I wish I was only in six.
My six auto new leagues specifically.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, just my six auto new leagues.
Just to throw one more platform out there, just because it's my predominant platform, or my primary, I guess I should say. He's only owned in 76.7% of ESPN leagues, and I brought up the suspension, him being dropped. He's down 7.7% this week in ESPN leagues because of that suspension.
I'm with you. I would be grabbing him. If he's a free agent, he's an easy pickup. Any format, any league, there's somebody on your roster you should be dropping to pick up Jesse Winker. In auto new leagues where he's not going to be readily available, or deeper leagues where he may not be a free agent, like, I'd poke around, right? He's the perfect guy to, I think, reach out to someone and be like, hey, I need an outfielder. I'm interested in Winker. You know, what would it take?
Because yeah.
Some managers are going to be like, and like, honestly, if somebody reaches out to me and asks to buy Winker, I'm most likely to say like, no, I still believe in him. Like, yeah, I would trade him, but like, you're paying full freight for him.
Right.
And then you're probably not going to buy, but there are going to be plenty of managers out there who either weren't as high on him to start with, or are happy to move on from him or whatever. And I'd poke around for sure. So we're going to jump to my next guy now. And this is a guy I went back and forth between him and one of his teammates because I didn't love the Mets, I guess. But JD Davis. JD Davis is, and this is going to be a little different. I'm sort of starting to talk myself out of him doing the research for this episode. The other guys so far, I haven't been able to bail on yet, but I always felt like Davis, a little bit like Senzel, but in a different way. Like, he just needed consistent playing time. Just the reason he wasn't getting it was very different than why Senzel wasn't. He just was buried on that team, and they didn't have a DH, and they needed it, and blah, blah, blah. And now there's a DH, but he really isn't turning things around. Like, it's not even turning things around. That's not even the right way to say it, because, like, ever since he came to the Mets, he was awesome in 2019. He was very good in 2020. He was awesome in 2021. And he's just fallen off this year now that he's getting more playing time. And to give you a sense of what I mean by more playing time is, he had a total of 211 plate appearances last year. He has 186 already this year. So he is playing a lot. And it's still, the problem is, I don't think enough. Right. That's still like 56. He's played 56 games. The Mets have probably played like 85-ish, something like that. And so, like, he's still sitting out more than a third of their games, but he's just not hitting this year. He's got a 315 WOBA. It was 357 the year before, 339 the year before that, 373 the year before that. And it's not just, you know, hitting the ball the same and not getting the same results, because his X WOBA, actually, I take that back. His X WOBA is 371. Wow, I did not realize he had that good an ex-WOBA. Okay, I said I was going to talk myself out of him, but maybe I didn't. Because what I was getting ready to say was he's fallen off, and now I can't, like, it went from, like, he doesn't play enough, but he's so good when he plays, and I need to have him. And now it's starting to feel like, okay, but now he's not even hitting that well, so, like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm no longer clamoring him for play every day, but, like, 371 ex-WOBA. And the reason for that, now that I'm looking at this, his 12.4% barrel rate this year ties what he had last year. That's his career high between the two of them. He has an average exit velocity this year of 94 and a hard hit rate of 61%.
It's just ridiculous. It's the 100th percentile. Yeah.
You're right. His hard hit rate is a 100th percentile hard hit rate, 98th percentile exit velocity, 83rd percentile barrel rate. The challenge for him this year is strikeouts. That's sort of, that's, you know, he's never been a super low strikeout guy, but, like, 2019, 2020, between those 2 years, he struck out 22.4% of the time. Last year and this year combined, he's at 31.7%. That's 32.2% last year, 31.2% this year. So it's just a high, high strikeout rate. He still walks over 10% of the time. And as you know, I love those guys who walk a lot, but yeah, I mean, now I'm like, he's hitting the ball really well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm poking at that strikeout rate and realizing that, like, his swinging strike rate has always been kind of terrible. Like, not always, I guess. 2020 and 2021, he was at 12.4 and 12.5%, but the last 2 years, it's at 19.4% and 17.6%. those are really high swinging strike rates, and that explains why his strikeout rate is so high. Maybe he could do something about bringing his contact rate back up, and that would help. But I don't know. Right now, it's sort of a weird situation where, like, he seems to be hitting the ball well, but his home run per fly ball rate is low. His fly ball rate is only 27.6%. So he's, like, not hitting many fly balls. He's apparently not hitting his fly balls very well because his home run per fly ball rate is abysmal. But I don't know. He's still hitting the ball hard. He's barreling it at a really high rate. Now I'm torn. I was all ready to tell you, like, if he's not going to hit better than he's hitting, then the fact that he isn't playing enough is enough to just move on. But he's hitting the ball pretty well. So maybe he's a buy low. Now I can't decide.
And this conversation kind of reminds me of our conversation about Christopher Morel. And for different reasons, I don't think they're similar players. But, and obviously the issue for Davis, one of the issues is playtime, and that's not a concern for Christopher Morel, obviously, not at this point anyway. But it's this idea that they just whiff too much, that, like, on contact, they're very good. And JD Davis is much better on contact than Christopher Morel, who so far has been pretty damn good on contact. It's just the whiffs. I mean, you brought up the strikeout rate, that it's continued to get worse. If he can find a way to cut down on the whiffs and get consistent playing time, well, now we're really talking, because this dude smokes the ball. And I still have him in our Fangraphs league, or our points league. I still have him there. I'm still rostering him for like $2, because every now and then he has those like two homer games. I think he had one the other day. But that's it. I mean, it's the whiffs. You look at that. The whiff percentage for JD Davis, I mean, it's 37.1. The league average is 24.6. Like, if he can cut down on the strikeouts, I'm in, because on contact, he's great. But I don't know how much of the, like, quality of contact will go down if he does find a way to cut down on the strikeouts. I don't know. And is he going to have an opportunity to do that with the playtime? But you're right. I mean, he's a guy that's, like, interesting to look at under the hood, because you see the 701 OPS and you're like, oh, this guy sucks. But then you see that hard hit rate and the barrel rate and everything else, and there's something there. But to get untapped, he needs play time, and he's got to cut down on the strikeouts.
Yeah, and I don't know what he does about those strikeouts, because it is not, like, it's now going on two seasons of just absurdly high swing and miss, and that's a challenge to fix, and I don't think it's going to fix overnight, but it's probably worth watching. I'm sort of curious now to look at, like, is it at least trending the right direction? Which maybe it is. Let's see. Go to look at his game log and pull up plate discipline. And let's look since June 1st. His swinging strike rate is 18.6%, which is actually higher than his season total.
Not so, what we wanted to see.
No, it is not moving the right direction. His contact on pitches in the zone is up, but out of the zone is down. Maybe he just needs to chase less. I don't know. But he is still swinging through way too many pitches. I just cut down to June 20th as just sort of an arbitrary day to see if maybe in the last, like, couple of weeks it's gotten better. His swing strike rate since June 20th is 19.4%, even higher than it was.
God.
So it's trending the wrong direction.
Yeah, his strikeout rate since then is 42%.
Yeah. What's crazy, though, is that even with that strikeout rate, he still has that ex-WOBA of, what did I say, 370?
It was around, so, like, 360 something, maybe.
Because that's 371. And that should account for that, right? Like, a high strikeout rate is part of what goes into your ex-WOBA, right? Your ex-WOBA is looking at what would we expect you to do given your strikeouts and your walks and your quality of contact. So that's built into that. So maybe I should just accept the 30% strikeout rate and assume, I mean, there must be some projection that his home run per fly ball rate is going to go up. That's the only thing I can think of, because his BABIP is already 363. So he's not having bad BABIP luck. His fly ball rate isn't high, and I don't think ex-WOBA is expecting an increase in fly ball rate. So it must be some sort of, he must just be having bad luck on barreling up balls that are not turning into home runs, I guess. I don't know. Looking at that, I don't know that I want to buy a guy who's striking out that much and whose strikeouts and swing and miss are trending the wrong direction. But
you don't want to quit him.
I don't really want to quit him. His roster percentage in Auto New, by the way, is only 33%, which means it's probably very low in most other formats.
Oh, for sure.
Although, interestingly, it's 33%. He is rostered in every single one of my six leagues. By you in one of them.
Yep, that's right.
You've got him in the Fangraphs Staff League. I've got him in one of my leagues. But he's rostered in all of my leagues. And yet he's only rostered in a third of all leagues. Interesting.
That is.
Yeah, maybe that's my fault. Maybe I'm just too high on him and keeping his roster percentage inflated in my leagues. But
I would not roster him if you weren't so high on him. That's the chat effect. I was like, all right, I'll hang on to JD Davis. So you're inflating his percentage just a little bit for sure.
At least by one league.
At least by one league.
All right. Okay, well, let's move on from JD Davis. I think the sort of, I don't know that we actually came to any sort of like great conclusion or anything there, but he is still hitting the ball really, really well. He's just striking out way too much, sort of what he is. We've talked about four hitters so far. We should talk about some pitchers as well. And interestingly, we both picked former Cleveland starting pitchers. The first one we're going to start with is your choice, and that is Corey Kluber. Let's talk about why you can't quit Corey Kluber.
Yeah, I can't. I keep thinking of reasons to drop him, and I can't. He's 36 years old now, and I'm not. I mean, we obviously know he throws a ton of different pitches, really three primary, and they've actually kind of flipped over the last 2 years. But the big thing is, right, the velocity is now on average below 90 miles an hour, and obviously you've got to be a really good pitcher who hits his spots if you're going to be successful throwing that soft. He is years and years and years removed from his 2014 Cy Young, but I want to bring that up for a second. Not his 2017 Cy Young, but his 2014, because I want to highlight just how good of a, how like much of a precision pitcher Corey Kluber can be. Where if we look at his swinging strike rate in 2014, when he won a Cy Young, it was 12%. That's not that amazing. And this year it's at 11.2. And his O swing was 35.1 in 2014. And now it's actually at 37.3, which would be a career high, which is what you want to see because he wants to rely on being more deceptive than like living in the zone because he's not throwing that hard. So that right off the bat is like kind of promising. He can still miss bats, not at an elite clip, but at a good enough clip. And he's tricking guys. His O swing is again at a career high. He pitches to contact, but he's still been hard to square up. 87.4 average exit velocity against, and he doesn't give up any free passes. His career low walk rate right now is 3.9%. He's not walking anybody. So to score off him, half the time it's going to be in Tropicana where it's already hard to hit. You have to put the ball in play. And he's been a hard guy to barrel up. If you need strikeouts, you're not going to add Corey Kluber. And if you need strikeouts, you might cut him. But he will occasionally frustrate you. He's been on a strict pitch count this year. I'm trying to find it right now, but I can't find where to like filter by pitch count by start. But I can tell you that he hasn't thrown more than six innings pitched in a single start this year. Like at most, it's been 6.0, but he's done that a few times. But I kind of look at that as a good thing. His no-hitter last year with the Yankees, that clearly blew his shoulder out or whatever it was. And the Rays are taking, you know, obviously, because they're the Rays and they drive me crazy. But in this case, I'm really happy with it. A super cautious approach. I would be surprised if he's thrown more than 90 pitches this year. Like, that's how cautious
he has, actually. So
how many times?
His game log. He has gone 290 pitches three times. He's got a 90 in his first start of the year. Wait, is that his first start? That's not his first start of the year. Hold on. Oh, there's a whole button I have to push here. the pitcher list game log shows you like the last 10 starts and you have to expand it to show everything. So now I'm just
good to know
everything. He went to 90 pitches for the first time on May 16th. He went to the 93 on June 14th and 92 on June 19th. Those are the only three times he's hit 90.
That's out of 16 starts.
Yeah, he's gone to 90 pitches three times out of 16 starts. He's got another one at 89. He's got another one at 87. It looks to me like they are trying to get him out of the game around 80.
Yeah.
And they are pulling him at 90. But by pulling him at 90, I think what that really means is like if he's thrown 85, 86, they'll maybe let him get another hitter or finish an inning. If he's got 89, 90, then he's done. Is what it seems to be so far. Now, I don't know if that's a, knowing the Rays, I would guess that's not a, like, they don't seem like the kind of organization that would be focused on pitch count as much as like some sort of concept of fatigue or how hard he's thrown or, you know, leverage in innings and stuff
both.
Like that. Right.
I'm sure it all comes into play. Yeah. And it's been something that's...
My guess is he's not... Kevin Cash is not sitting in the dugout and he's like, 88, 89. Okay, go get him. Go get him at 90. Yeah. Go get him right. Like, but it seems like as he gets up to 90, somewhere in that 80 to 90 range, they're just like, that's good enough. You're right. He has not gone over six innings in a single start. If you're in quality start leagues, he has only gotten to six innings, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 times. So he only has a shot at a quality start roughly half the time. Now, in those 8 times that he's gotten to six innings, he has gotten a quality start in every single one of them.
Well, that's actually what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean he's been effective. Like in quality, I have him in a quality start league, and that's why I noticed it. Where it's like, yeah, he's on such a strict pitch count, but he's actually been really successful in actually getting to those quality starts. If we broke down his 16 starts, in 75% of them, 12 of his 16 starts, he's only given up 0, 1, or 2 earned runs. That's it. And then of the 4 other outings, if we wanted to really expand upon this, one of them was just 3 earned runs. So that's fine. We'll take that. And if he got to 6 innings that outing, which he did not, it obviously still would have been a quality start. The other was a nuclear explosion against the Angels where he gave up 8 earned runs. And that is taking a serious toll on his overall ratios. I'd want to see what his numbers look like if we just take out that one start, which I know is a dangerous game, but still. And then the other 4 earned runs against Boston, a very good offense, and 5 earned runs against Toronto, a better offense. So, like, all of that's understandable. I'm in on Corey Kluber. I keep seeing his roster percentage, like, going down. It's super low on ESPN. But, like, what is not to like, assuming you're not in a strikeouts per nine league where, obviously, it would hurt you? He's been pretty reliable for a good team that I think has a good process in keeping him fresh.
Yeah, and, I mean, he is his repertoire. Like, he is mixing, basically, his cutter, sinker, and curveball, which he's always... mix, but he's throwing his cutter more than ever. And that's basically because he's abandoned his four seamer, which makes sense because his four seamer that used to be 92 has been 88.9 this year. But he's only throwing it 0.7% of the time. He's a show me pitch, if anything. He has thrown it. I mean, I'm looking at this now. It's possible he's only thrown like 8 of them or something. That can't be right. 0.7% of the time, 8 would be 1 out of 1,000. That could be right.
According to Statcast, he's thrown his four seamer 7 times.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that makes some sense. And he is not throwing it in the zone. Like, he's only throwing it in the zone 25% of the time. League average on a four seamer is 50%. So he's just using it as a show me pitch. But he's mixing that cutter, sinker, and curveball. He's also using his changeup more than he used to. His cutter, which is his primary pitch right now, he's using it 35.4% of the time. It has a slightly above average zone rate. So league average zone rate on a cutter is 46.1%. He's throwing into the zone 47.8% of the time, so a little bit more than average. His O swing on a cutter, league average is 29.4%. He's getting chases on 40% of his cutters. That is a big, big number. And as a result, at least I assume it's as a result of that, he's managing an above average whiff rate on his cutter as well, which, as you said, like, he doesn't have the same swing and miss stuff he used to, but he's still getting more whiffs than you'd expect because he's locating, he's being deceptive, and it is that cutter that's really driving it. Like, he has a league average whiff rate on his curveball, a slightly below league average whiff rate on his sinker. His cutter is what's keeping him sort of up at league average, and actually his change is up as well. So he's mixing pitches really well. None of those pitches are like great. As impressed as I was with the chase rate of the cutter, it's not like it's a, you know, league changing, league leading cutter. It's just a good enough cutter mixed with 4 pitches. And so, like, yeah, you're saying you can't quit him. I don't know why you would. He's got a 3.62 ERA and a 3.43 FIP, 3.84 XFIP, 3.73 Sierra, and a 3.92 XERA. So, like, just across the board, he's just pitching well. Like, all of the ERA indicators are good. Everything looks good. I think he'd probably get himself into trouble if he were trying to go 7-8 innings. The Rays just aren't going to let him do it. As you said, right? This is a case where, like, being on the Rays is sort of the perfect place for him to be. So, yeah, don't quit Corey Kluber. Like, keep him out there because he's just been very, very good. And again, I'm sort of curious to see what his roster percentages are.
So he's on ESP,
at CBS.
What is it on CBS?
86%.
Yeah, on ESPN, it's literally half that. It's 43.2. And just because of that one Toronto outing, he went down 6.9%. And then he went out against Boston the very next start. Six innings, no earned runs, no walks, three hits, five strikeouts. And he not only got a quality start, he got the win too. So he got right back on the horse. And as long as he's healthy and they continue to treat him with kid gloves, which I have no reason to think they won't, like, why not ride this out?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So from one 36-year-old former Guardian to a 35-year-old former Guardian, I pulled up Carlos Carrasco as a guy I can't quit. And I want to start by pointing out that a good chunk of why I can't quit Carrasco is who he is as a person. And he was in many ways the heart and soul of some of those Cleveland teams that he was on. He, you know, he dealt with the cancer issue when he was with Cleveland and had that moment at the All-Star game in Cleveland a few years ago. And he, you know, he took a hometown discount to stay with Cleveland and they got traded away as part of the Francisco Lindor trade. And like, I just like Cookie. I like the guy. I want him to do well. I will fully admit that part of the reason I can't quit him is because I don't want to. I want him to be successful. However, there are also baseball reasons I can't quit him. And so to start with, and this is the most obvious, this is such a surface level thing, but like, he has a 4.55 ERA and a 3.59 FIP. He has a 344 BABIP on the year. That won't continue. It just won't. He's not a, there's no reason to think that he'll continue to give up a BABIP that is that high. But that's what's happened to him so far. And as a result, his surface numbers look a lot worse than they should. His xERA is 3.98, which is very similar to where Kluber's was. Kluber's was 3.92. So, you know, FIP is going to assume sort of a league average BABIP. He has been giving up some hard contact, and so it's not totally fair to assume that league average BABIP, but I think it'll be a lot better than what it's been, for sure. He's striking out enough guys. He's got over 9 strikeouts per 9 inning, 23.7% strikeout rate. His 17.6% strikeout minus walk rate is solid. I just, all in all, I think he's pitching better than his overall line would suggest. And part of that is bad luck. Part of it is he's had a couple of just brutal starts, and they happened right in a row. He had the misfortune to face Houston twice in 6 days, and they just teed off on him. Between those two starts, he went 6 2/3 innings. He gave up 11 earned runs on 10 hits, struck out 6, and walked 5. And like, he's only given up 47 earned runs on the year. So that's like a quarter of his earned runs came in those two starts against one team that he will not face again this year. So, he's had other not great starts. He gave up 5 runs against Philadelphia. He gave up 4 against Seattle. And he had an 8-run implosion against St. Louis. So, you know, part of this with Carrasco is like, be smart about when you use him. Like, I would have used him against St. Louis. I would have given, I had that 8-run implosion. That was super unfortunate. But I wouldn't have started him against Houston, and I wouldn't have started him against Philadelphia. And that would have taken a big chunk off of what he's given up this year. But I'm going to keep rolling him out there because I think he's still a very good pitcher. I don't think his surface line numbers reflect just how good he's been. And the reality for me is, well, you know, I commented before that like, oh, I really just like, I want him to do well. I want players on my fantasy teams I want to cheer for. I like having guys on my fantasy teams that I'm excited about and that I feel good when they do well. And like, you know, this comes down to like, when we start to have conversations about guys like Trevor Bauer and people are like, oh, you know, what difference does it make if you roster him? Because like, it doesn't change who he is. You're not contributing to it. Like, the reason I don't want to roster Trevor Bauer, besides the fact that he's not going to play ever again or whatever, but like guys like that, is I don't want to cheer for them. I don't want to support them. I don't want to feel good when they pitch well. Carrasco is the opposite of that. It's like, I want to be invested in him. I want when he goes out and throws a good start to be like, yes, I care about that. I'm excited for him. I'm excited for me. This is good. And so that's what I'm going to do. And so I'm going to keep rostering him. I'm using him. I'm a Carrasco fan.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. To clarify for our listeners, and Chad, I assume you would agree, I would rather roster Carlos Carrasco than Corey Kluber. I think Carrasco has more strikeout upside. I think he's more likely to go deeper into games. He hasn't over the last like month and a half or so. He really hasn't gone over like six innings in a while, or maybe he had one 6-inning outing. And then otherwise since like June 6th, he hasn't, but that's partly because you brought up those two outings to Houston. He was just kind of in a rut. I mean, look, the guy's BABIP is absurdly high right now. Like that's down, that's due to come down, right? His BABIP against is up at 344. And his velocity on his fastball, like something you look at when guys begin to age, and we brought up the velocity with Kluber, his velocity on his fastball really hasn't changed in the last 4 years. Like it's right there at 93 to 94 miles an hour. So I don't really see a case for some massive regression just because he's a little bit older and dealt with some injuries and obviously had the cancer scare. And the swinging strike rate's still 13%. Like we'll take that. It's not where it was during his prime years where he was up over 15 a couple of times, but 13%, that's not bad. So Carrasco, I look at it, he could be a potential horse in the second half, a guy who could go a little bit deeper into games and give you the strikeouts. So I don't know where you're at in Carrasco versus Kluber, but I think if somebody offered me their Carrasco for my Kluber, I think I would take that trade.
Yeah, I would too. I was sort of curious to pull up, and I pulled up Nick's list, the list on Pitcher List from this week. And I was curious to see how he had them ranked. He has Carrasco 58th in a tier with guys like Taijuan Walker, Miles Michaelis, Adam Wainwright, Tyler Anderson, Noah Syndergaard, Jameson Taillon, and Martin Perez. That's tier 8 for Nick. He has Kluber in tier 10 down at 74 with Paul Blackburn, Marco Gonzalez, Drew Rasmussen, David Peterson, Merrill Kelly, Cal Quantrill, Chris Flexen, Devin Smeltzer, and Tyler Wells. I kind of think that's too low for Kluber, but about right for Carrasco-ish. So sure. I still think I would still take Carrasco over Kluber, but I think it's a little closer than that suggests.
It also could be a needs thing.
Do you agree with that?
Right? Like if I need strikeouts, wins, or qualities. Yeah, like if I need strikeouts, wins, or quality starts, I'm taking Carrasco. But if I need ratios, then maybe I would take Kluber. He's walking literally nobody, and that is not the case with Carrasco, especially lately.
Yeah. Well, looking at just another expert that I trust, Ido Saris, on his most recent rankings, had Carrasco 65th and Kluber 80th. So very similar. He's a little lower on both of them. Yeah, I guess that's, you know, that seems to be about where they belong then, I guess. If, you know, usually to me, if Nick and Ido agree, I'm probably just going to defer to them. I think they're both a little low on Kluber. I think Ido is a little low on Carrasco. I think Carrasco's top 60 and I think Kluber is top 70.
Sure.
But I think Carrasco is better than Kluber. I would agree with that. I actually think one of the things that may work to Carrasco's advantage is that he may not need to be a horse in the second half, right? Hopefully in the second half, they're getting regular 7-8 inning type outings out of DeGrom and Scherzer.
Oh, that would be nice.
And then that's allowing their bullpen to be more rested for some of their less elite pitchers. And as much as I like Carrasco, he certainly belongs in a category of less elite for sure. So.
Something else about those rankings, like, you know, the difference between 62 and 87 sometimes is something so minuscule that the difference in number looks huge, but in terms of what they actually expect from those pitchers might not be that different.
Yeah, and that was why I mentioned the tiers, because for Nick, where he does tiers, you can, you know, tier 8 versus tier 10 is sort of, it's at
that's
least
noticeable. Yeah.
But yeah, to me, they should be one tier apart, not two. But that's mostly because I think Kluber should be a tier up. That's basically what I'm saying. So, yeah, but I like both of them. I think if you can get either of them, I would. They're not sort of readily available, but they're also the kind of guys that, again, in trade talks, I'm not sure other managers are going to be like, no, these guys are untouchable. Like team who has a Carrasco or Kluber and could afford to trade pitching for hitting, I would look at that. I would poke in at that. So we've gone for almost an hour 10 here. But you had a keeper question you wanted to discuss. So why don't we talk quickly about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it's one that people are probably dealing with because it's about Bobby Witt Jr., who is in this middle ground between he's not one of the prospects who's completely fallen on his face. If anything, he's closer to the opposite because he's 12 homers, 13 stolen bases. We'll take that. The average looks poor, but everything under the hood looks great. He looks like he's probably going to be eventually what we all expected from him. But my buddy Chris in our favorite league here has him. And to keep him, he'd have to give up basically the equivalent of a first round pick because we've changed our rules this year and this is the first year we're doing it. And we could get into that, but there's no need to. Essentially, Bobby Witt Jr. would basically cost him a first round pick to keep. The reason for that is because he was kept last year. And so now his keeper value is a first round pick. Now, he's on the fence, or he actually seems kind of convinced that he's going to keep Bobby Witt Jr., which would mean that he probably doesn't have either of his first two picks because he's also probably going to keep Trey Turner. And he has other options that would be way less. For example, he's got an MJ Melendez, not that he would really be an option.
Is Turner going to cost his first round pick or his second? He'd have to give up a first for Turner and then basically give up his second to also keep Witt?
Essentially, yes. They both cost a first, but he has the ability to keep both for a first and a second. So if you want to look at Witt as a second rounder, I think that's a lot easier to stomach. And it's a 16-team league.
I think it's the right way to look at it, right? Because
for sure,
if he decides Witt's not worth a first rounder, I'm not keeping him, he's still going to, that doesn't change Turner. And Turner is the more, Turner for a first. I could make a case that I don't want to keep Turner for a first. I don't think I want to make that case because I think Turner is a top three pick, and unless he's picking in the top three, and I don't see it. I think more than likely, more than likely, giving up your first to keep Turner is fine because your alternative is to not give up your first and then draft Turner, which maybe we could discuss that. I think there is a case to be made that if you've got really good, interesting keepers later, you keep them and then you just use your first round pick to get Turner without using a keeper spot on him. But I also don't know. Do you have a limited number of keeper spots? You keep three, right?
Keep three.
Yeah. So I could see a case if he had five great keepers and couldn't keep them all, then throw Turner back and just use your first round pick on Turner or someone like Turner. I could totally see that. So regardless though, assuming he's keeping Turner, then it really is a question of Witt for a second. And I don't think that's a hard choice. I don't think there's any way I would keep Witt for a second.
So you're out on Witt.
I don't mean it that way, but in this situation,
you are out on Witt for a set, even in a 16 teamer.
I just think I'm trying to think about what was his ADP this year. Let me see something. Baseball ADP. Let's see if I can pull something up real quick. Looking at Fantasy Pros, just because I don't know where else to look that isn't I don't want to use NFBC because that's not a good comp for this. But Witt Fantasy Pros was his ADP was around 98. How many teams are in your league?
16.
Okay, so in a 16 teamer, 98 is what, a fifth or sixth round pick?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, 5 times 16 would, so the last pick of the 5th round would be the 80.
Yeah.
So it's actually an early 7th round pick is what it is.
Right.
Has Bobby Witt Jr. done anything this year to suggest that he should move up from being a 7th round pick to being a 1st round pick or even a 2nd round pick? I think he's moved up because I think he's held his own and he's been but he hasn't, it's not like he's been a world beater and sort of unquestionably one of the best players out there and blah, 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 blah. I just don't think he's been good enough that I'm he's a second round pick. If I had a second round pick, I wouldn't use it on Bobby Witt Jr.
See, that's the thing right there that I think people need to keep in mind with this, because this is a new change for us because ESPN changed their rules. We talked about this months ago, right, where it may hurt thinking but I could lose Bobby Witt. But that means you're getting your second round pick, and he's probably going to be there in the second round if you really like him that much. And his other values, Chad, like his other options, right? So let's assume he keeps Trey Turner. I probably would, especially given his other options. They're not like that great. But Zach Wheeler for a fourth round pick, Luis Severino for an eighth round pick, MJ Melendez, I only bring him up again because he's basically free to keep. It's his last round pick. And he did just add Nolan Jones. Maybe he becomes something. He'd be worth a last round pick. Those are really his options. There's nothing else that really jumps off the page. But to me, I'm keeping Trey Turner, Wheeler, and Severino, and I'm seeing if Witt is there in the second round. If he is, there might actually be somebody I like more at that point.
I think there will be someone you like more. Like I'm looking. So now I'm looking at the Razzball player rater. Now, I personally think the player raters in general overvalue stolen bases, which means that they're going to be higher on Witt than they should. They have him 48th. 48th is the last pick of the third round in a 16-teamer. I don't know where this guy is in the standings, so if I don't know if he's picking, you know, 17th or 32nd when the draft comes around, but there is no way I want to be using, let's say on average, the 25th pick on Bobby Witt Jr. It's just not, it's not where I want to be picking him, at least not at this point. Now, maybe that'll change over the rest of the season. Like, he has time to reach another level. But right now, he is not a second round pick to me. So,
can I just affirm you even more that in this particular situation, there's not five offensive categories. There's actually seven. So stolen bases are worth less. One of those extra categories is walks, and Bobby Witt's sporting a less than 6% walk rate. So
yeah, he's not walking at all.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Because
what's the other extra category?
Total bases, which Bobby Witt's good for.
Yeah, he is. He's got a decent number of doubles and triples, doesn't he?
Yeah. To me, with that category, guys like him and Bo Bichette, they go up.
Yeah.
He seems convinced he's keeping him. And our trade deadline is usually absolute fireworks, so who knows what's going to happen. But I've been thinking about it for a while. That's why I brought it up on the show, and I think my mindset is kind of where yours is, where like, he's going to have to really go nuts in the second half, which he might, to be worth a second round pick.
So Razzball player rater allows me to use a 6x6 setting to look at ratings as well. And the sixth one they add is OPS. OPS is not a terrible proxy
for total bases. Yeah, I agree.
He moves up to 43rd from 48th, which is still not a second round pick. And that, as you said, walks would move him down.
Right.
So maybe total bases and walks is sort of a wash, and he still ends up around 48 to 50. I don't see it. I don't see him being worth a second round pick, at least not based on what he's done to date.
Sure.
All right. Well, with that, thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed this one. We will be back with you next week. As a reminder, you can follow the show at Keep or Cut on Twitter. You can also subscribe, leave ratings and reviews anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can follow Pete at Pete B Baseball. You can find me at Chad Young. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll talk to you next week.